We have this notion of lech lecha in Hebrew, which means go forward, go into your going. It's what God says to Abraham, to the land I'll show you. Go out from this place to the unknown. And I had been resisting that. And this was the path that was being shown to me. It just took me a long time to realize, but it took Abraham a long time too.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Today on In Good Faith, I'm really excited to talk about music with a music maker. And not just talk about music, but actually hear some beautiful Jewish songs for Shabbat or the Sabbath. I do remember being 10 years old and having a great organist in our congregation, and it came time for us to sing A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. I'd never really paid that much attention to the hymns, but as a 10-year-old who did love drawing hundreds of little army men on my homework, much to my teacher's frustration, I was way into fortresses. But I got my first glimpse of the grandeur of worship music when the organist pulled out all the stops to play that hymn, A Mighty Fortress, with its minor chords. And I remember sitting there, forgetting about army men, and thinking, this is what they mean when they talk about the power of God, what I am feeling right now from the music. And I think ever since, music has been the most important vehicle of worship for me and of making a place or an event holy. And that's exactly what our guest today does for his synagogue every week. Cantor Adam Davis is the cantor at Congregation Kol Ami in Salt Lake City, Utah. He served communities in New York, California, Illinois, Maryland, and Virginia. Cantor Davis has composed many original songs and musical settings of Jewish prayers. His Uvchein was published in 2023 by Transcontinental Music Publications as part of High Holy Days Anthology, Volume 2.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher kideshanu b'mitzvotav V'tzivanu le'hadlikne shel Shabbat.
A cantor, as you might infer, is a singer. But more than that, the role of the cantor is to lead the congregation in prayer and in song. The Talmud teaches that before a congregation even hires a rabbi, they should hire a cantor. That's just a little professional plug. But the role of the cantor is one of music and spirituality, working with the children to train them as they become ready for their bar and bat mitzvah. That's a very traditional kind of view of what a cantor does. These days, the modern cantor is full clergy in partnership with rabbis. We do life cycle events. We do pastoral care. We sometimes do counseling. We do weddings and funerals. It's really kind of a full portfolio. Interestingly, the word in Hebrew that we sometimes hear for cantor is chazan. Chazan is related to the word chazon, which means vision. And the role traditionally of the chazan would be to paint the text in such a way that even if you didn't really know exactly what the words were, you'd get a sense of what was happening in the prayer, and also know, based on the nusach being used, what time of day it was and what time of year it was, because there are specific modes and melodies for each time of year. And so the chazan would be the preserver of that tradition and help lead the congregation in the daily life of its worship.
Would your parents, if I could have talked to them when you were about 8, be surprised where you ended up?
Actually, it was a surprise, or so my mother tells me. When I appeared on stage at my elementary school's winter holiday concert, I had heard over the announcements as a kindergartner that the choir was looking for new singers. And if you wanted to come and join the choir to show up in the music room after school, which I did, and I didn't realize it, but it was intended for the upper school members, the fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. And here comes the kindergartner joining the choir. But the music teacher knew well enough to let me sing along. And I auditioned for and got a solo for this concert. And I don't know why, but I didn't tell my parents. And so when the curtain pulled back, I was singing the introduction and first verse of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And apparently someone turned to my mother and said, "Oh, you must be very proud to know that he was going to do this." And she said, "I had no idea." But we were a very musical family. And all throughout my childhood, I found opportunities to sing with groups, whether it was through school or through our synagogue, which my family helped to start in suburban Chicago. So music was with me from a very early age.
When did you figure out the connection between music and worship, that those went together?
Well, I don't think I ever had an aha moment, because it was so seamless in our tradition. When we would recite the blessings on Friday night together around the table over the wine and the challah, the bread, and the candles, those blessings are always sung. So from a very early age, that was just kind of obvious to me that the two went hand in hand.
And that was totally evident to me when I've gone to Congregation Kol Ami, both for a service for where two teenagers got up to chant some of the Torah along with the cantor, and also at a service during the High Holy Days. And then suddenly hearing this choir singing in the loft. Yes, it all flowed so seamlessly between spoken word and chanted scripture and sung music.
The word for soul in Hebrew is neshama, and the word for breath is neshima. So they're the same root word. And so our soul and our breath are so deeply connected. And when we sing, the essence of our soul joins with that of other people's voices and rises to the heavens. In my congregation growing up, we always sung and there was always harmony. So it wasn't until I think I was in college and I attended services with my college roommate in Cincinnati, and it was a very different kind of congregation where it was much more frontal, much more presentational, and no one sang. And I was so surprised by that.
And missed it, probably.
Yeah, I wondered. It wasn't that there wasn't music. It's just that people weren't singing. And I found that very strange. But there are many forms of prayer. And what I've learned is that singing is its own spiritual practice. You know, the Hasidic teachers, the mystics, explain that a melody is its own pure form of prayer, that when we sing, we pray twice. There's the words and there's the music. I always feel like the two things are combined, but there's a practice of wordless singing in Judaism, akin to chanting. It's called nigun, which literally means melody. And just by singing a melody that repeats and harmonizing with people and joining your voices together, you can achieve a certain state of spirituality that you might not otherwise have.
I love what you taught us about. I'm thinking of God breathing the breath of life into Adam.
The Ruach Elohim, the breath of God.
Yeah, and that tying together with what it means to pray or to sing, because certainly music does, to me, bring the service to life, at least worship for me. Mm-hmm. And even that idea of a wordless melody is really intriguing and beautiful. In the middle of doing everything else you did, founded a Jewish arts organization, Kfar.
Yeah. And
aside from the music that you do in the synagogue, why was that important?
It was important because even though I was active in synagogue life, I was very aware, keenly aware, that there were people who were never going to set foot into a synagogue or a temple. It just was not their bag. Either they had some kind of traumatic experience when they were young, or there are Jewish atheists, there are Jewish agnostics. It might surprise people to learn that maybe only 40 or 50%, less than 50% of Jews in North America affiliate with a synagogue or temple. One can be a Jew in the street and not have a faith association. You can be a cultural Jew.
That's who you were reaching out to then.
Yeah. There was something that was happening in the late 90s in the big coastal cities, especially New York, where there was a cultural revival happening. There were all kinds of musicians and visual and theater artists who were starting to explore their Jewish identity through their craft. And some of them were drawing on deep reservoirs of spiritual practice. They may have come from a more observant background. Some of them were exploring their cultural identity through klezmer or other forms of music, or even there were Sephardic musicians, Jews from the Spanish and Middle Eastern traditions, who were starting to explore and meld their background, their knowledge, with more modern forms. So you had all these bands performing at, not in synagogues, but in clubs. And I was working in marketing at the time for, ironically, a liquor company. And I wasn't totally thrilled with that line of work. I was like, what am I doing? I really want to do something to help my people. I really want to do something that's musical, interesting, and can reach the people that I want to reach and bring them closer to their identity without having to necessarily set foot into a building that they are uncomfortable with. And I was watching what was happening in New York, and I thought, if we could just have a little bit of that here in Chicago, it would be amazing. And then 9/11 happened, and I closed my laptop, and I thought, is this what I want to be doing when the plane hits the building? Yeah. Metaphorically, for me. Yeah. I was watching all that paper fly, and I thought, this is all, it's not important. It's not meaningful. I want to do what's meaningful to me and what I think is going to be meaningful to other people. And so I started this little thing. It was the summer of, I want to say, 2002. I heard about a group that was performing in New York and they were coming from overseas. And I thought, I wonder if I could divert them to Chicago, send an email out to all my friends and see who shows up. I was expecting maybe 20 people to show up, but 100 people showed up. It was great. And Kfar was born. And after about 10 years, we had done a couple hundred events, started working with cultural institutions, and it became a temporal community for people who were affiliated with synagogues and the Jewish community, who appreciated the music and the scene, and those who were on the periphery. And they could come together in spaces that felt safe for all of them, and they would look around the room and say, aha, my people are here.
When did you make the jump to, I'm going to train as a cantor, and that will help satisfy, I think, part of that need that you're talking about, that meaning making.
Yeah. Well, so the whole episode of Kfar is kind of a part of the winding road, as it were. Many people throughout my life had asked me up to that point and during that period, when are you going to become a cantor? My childhood rabbi asked me, my childhood cantor asked me, my grandparents would ask me, my camp directors, even my university professor. I studied musical theater in Cincinnati, and my college professor one day said to me, don't you think you'd rather be in the cantorate than a life on the stage? It's so much more fulfilling. And I thought he was trying to spook me a little bit. Uh-huh. But they were all onto something that I didn't necessarily know about myself. Fast forward to that financial crisis in 2008. I found myself, as I did sometimes, leading a minyan. A minyan is a Jewish prayer quorum. And I think the cantor of the synagogue was on vacation or something. And so they called me. And I was happy to do it. I did it often. And someone came up to me afterwards, as had become a bit of a pattern, and said, cantor, that was lovely. And I said, well, I'm not the cantor. And they said, right. Well, anyways, there's an opportunity with the Council for Jewish Elderly, which is an organization in Chicago. Now it's called Senior Life. They operate about 14 different residences with different licensures and abilities for seniors. Would you be interested in leading a service on a regular basis? And one thing led to another. And soon I was doing this on a weekly basis for several of such residences. And I still was not a cantor, but
at least in name.
Right. But I was getting these beautiful senior citizens calling me cantor. And it was very hard to correct them. It was very, they were very insistent. And it was around then that I realized it wasn't the call from on high. It wasn't even the call from within that I needed to respond to. It was the call of my people saying, you're my cantor. Not long thereafter, a congregation got in touch with me because they were looking for a cantor. Their search fell through. They wanted someone who could sing for the high holidays and lead services on Shabbat and train the kids for B'nai Mitzvah. Do you know anybody? And I said, I've got a guy. I know someone.
I know a guy.
Right. So, and that began the formal journey. But you know, in some ways, we have this notion of lech lecha in Hebrew, which means go forward, go into your going. It's what God says to Abraham, to the land I'll show you. Go out from this place to the unknown. And I had been resisting that. And this was the path that was being shown to me. It just took me a long time to realize, but it took Abraham a long time too. You know, he was older than I am before he set out from Ur. And, you know, the interesting thing is my Jewish name is Avram, which was Abraham's initial name, Avram. But I feel a kinship with my ancestor, that there's this journey that we all take, and it's never a straight line.
I'm wondering if, especially in those early years, working as a cantor, serving as a cantor, if there was a particular section of Torah or a song or something that really you felt connected you with the congregation or with the divine.
That's a great question.
I'm trying not to say, what's your favorite song? Because it's not that kind of a thing.
Right. In terms of the music in a song, there's a melody that my childhood rabbi would sing on the high holidays. Reuven Frankel, very special and lovely guy. He taught me Torah. He taught me how to chant. He taught me how to pray, as well as my grandfather. And I also learned from my childhood cantor, Chazan Joe Davis, no relation. And Joe was actually a lawyer. He did this for the pure love of it, a true amateur. And Joe and Reuven would sing this melody and they would harmonize. And Joe actually later on in life, sadly, developed brain cancer. And he, you know, this is a prayer that we sing on the high holidays. And there was that last high holidays and I was there and everyone knew this song, this melody would sing. And everyone knew this was the last Yom Kippur they would ever hear Joe do this. And so he was singing this song, and part of it is, the words are, Al tashlichenu liyet zikna, do not throw us away, do not cast us out in our moment of old age, in our time of weakness. And I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I'm misty just thinking about it.
Yeah.
And for him to be singing these words and the pureness of his voice, Al tashlichenu liyet zikna, Al tashlichenu liyet zikna, V'ruach koshecha. It was just amazing. And that particular melody shifted for me in that moment. It always was powerful because everyone knew it and sang it and harmonized. But the words really rang true there. Mm. You know, this prayer, Unetana Tokef, you know, that the day of judgment has arrived and who will live and who will die. It's not about who is worthy. It's about acknowledging our mortality, that we ultimately have one thing that we're given, and that's time. That's the only thing that we have. And so there's all these moments. And Joe taught me, he said, you know, Adam, every day we have to be thankful. That's what we're about as a people. Yehudim means those who are thankful. Yehuda, the name Judah, from which we get Jew, was Leah saying, I am thankful. I will give thanks for this child. And so every day we have, our sages teach, we have an obligation to say mea brachot, 100 blessings, which are really just tiny little opportunities to say thank you and to express gratitude for everything from being able to open our eyes in the morning to the food we eat, to the relationships and love we have. And that's the path to a life of meaning and sacred living. So those are things I learned along the way. You started by asking me a song, but you know, music can really help us take that journey and help us crack open our souls.
So mate, you just started answering my next question, which is when you are leading music, whether it's you yourself or everyone is singing as a congregation, what do you see happening? What does the music do to you and to the people there?
Well, I'll start with a teaching, if I can. There's a book called the Tikkuni Zohar. It's a commentary on the Kabbalistic teachings. There's a passage, my friend and teacher, Rabbi Deborah Sachs Mintz, brought this text to my attention, that there's a palace of tears, and you can only access this palace by crying. And there's a palace of nigun, a palace of song, and you can only access this palace by singing. Also, there's a palace of light and you can only enter it by studying Torah. But the connection between emotion and song is so intimate. And I think we spend a lot of our time in life walking the streets, building fortresses, as Sting once sang, a fortress around your heart. We build these defenses and put up barricades because we're afraid to show what we feel. And there's a vulnerability there. But prayer is about vulnerability. We begin our worship with kind of a warm-up act. There's always like kind of spiritualist calisthenics. Before we start the actual formal call to prayer, the Baruch Hu, there's like a whole bunch of other liturgy. And it takes a little bit to kind of open your heart. And you do that through song. And by getting just a little bit more comfortable and singing and feeling like this is safe space and I can think or utter my innermost concerns and prayers in this moment, that's really important. And so what I'm hoping to do as a prayer leader, as a chazan, is to help people achieve that state of openness and vulnerability. And my goal is to help people take that next step into that unknown journey in the day, in the week, and take the bricks down for just a little bit and open up and be vulnerable.
Thank you. Cantor Adam Davis, this is really fascinating. I've learned a lot from you. You are new in your post, not quite a year yet. Congratulations on that. The congregation, I'm sure, is glad to have you. And I'm wondering, you talked about this range of belief. Over time, you've lived long enough that I can ask you what you know about the idea of the divine now that you didn't when you were in your teens.
I've come to appreciate that the divine is what holds this universe together. The divine is what flows between us. The divine is what we all share. All of us, all of creation, has the spark of the divine in it. Even inanimate objects. When we wake up every morning, we have the great privilege of looking up and seeing the mountains and knowing that that mountain has been here for millions of years and has in it part of God it's a great reminder. And as it goes, as we are supposed to care for God's creation, we also have to care for one another. And so the essential piece of holiness, of Kedusha, is what we have between each other and how we maintain respect for one another, and not just in terms of different peoples and different cultures and religions and ethnicities, but what Martin Buber called the I and the thou, that there's something very sacred and special about the personal relationship we cultivate with one other person. And so that to me is like the essence of divinity. When I spoke about the neshima, the breath, right? There's something very special and unifying about joining our voices together. And that's the two ideas meeting, that we are distinct individuals, but ultimately it's that what's inside is the same. We all share these things. And when it gets mixed up into the atmosphere and then rises beyond the atmosphere into the heavens, God can distinguish our souls, but our soulfulness, that's indistinguishable. And that's the divine to me.
Avinu Malkeinu Choneinu Vaneinu Avinu Malkeinu Choneinu Vaneinu Ki ein banu maasi Haseima Honeinu vaneinu ki ein banu maasim.
Many thanks to cantor Adam Davis for speaking with me and playing for us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, Ocean Marshall, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. And we have an occasional newsletter. You could sign up for that at ingoodfaithpodcast.org. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith. You know, there are no perfect people, and there are no perfect families, and no perfect relationships. So how do we be good people and have good relationships and good families? How do we do better at what is most important to us? I'm here to tell you about The Lisa Show, another in the family of BYU Radio podcasts. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, a believer, a single mother. She delves into the challenges and the relationships that shape all of our lives, whether we're talking about parenting, mental health questions, social issues, being a caregiver. She and her council of moms tackle the topic. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but you'll also hear from the people who have been digging the trenches. She'll help you figure out this thing called life with lots of laughs along the way. It's The Lisa Show. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.